Okay, so I'm going to go fairly quickly because I have a lot of slides. So I'm talking about the efficient particle acceleration and collision of shocks. So I'm going to be saying a lot of the words that John said, just much quicker. And this is mainly cosmic ray production in young supernova remnants. So I'm going to talk brief summary of diffusive shock acceleration. We already heard some about that. But I want to emphasize the nonlinear effects that you get with non-relativistic shocks. Observations of young supernova remnants, broadband emission. This is important for understanding what's going on. Particularly, I'm going to talk about the morphology of supernova remnants, showing that this is clear evidence, I believe, for efficient nonlinear diffusive shock acceleration. A few words about G347 and the wonderful Hess observations. A word about the asymmetry of SM1006, and maybe I'll mention magnetic field amplification, but probably not. One at a time. Okay, from energy considerations, we know that supernovae are the only known source capable of producing the bulk of the galactic cosmic rays below the knee. The acceleration mechanism must be efficient, almost certainly. We need about 15% or more of the total supernova explosion energy to be put in the cosmic rays. Phyllis has a nice recent review where he goes through that. There's strong, totally convincing evidence that the outer blast wave shock accelerates electrons to relativistic energies in supernova remnants. Detailed observations of supernova remnants at many different wavelengths, this is one of my topics here, offer the hope of actually understanding the shock acceleration mechanism. We don't understand it fully yet, but you need broadband photon emission models to do this. And so I'm going to discuss only diffusive shock acceleration. That doesn't mean that other mechanisms may not be important, particularly second order, but I'm not going to discuss them. Problems. The unambiguous evidence for cosmic ray ion production in supernova remnants is still lacking, requires detection of a pine decay feature in GEV, TEV protons. Maybe we've seen this with Hess, but it's still not totally clear. What is the maximum energy supernova remnants can produce? It keeps getting pushed up every year, but there's still a problem. What is the maximum energy you can get from the isolated supernova remnant? This is an important problem for diffusive shock acceleration. The energetic particle spectra from individual supernova remnants, assuming that it's nonlinear, may be too flat, even with liberal interpretation of galactic propagation models, to explain the overall cosmic ray spectrum. If this is going to work, it means you're going to have complex models to explain the cosmic ray spectrum. Also, there are basic questions concerning shock acceleration, which we don't understand. Is the acceleration efficient enough in supernova remnants for nonlinear effects to be important? Still not clear how injection occurs, how it varies your obliquity. This whole business with magnetic field amplification now is really important and not understood. And it's clearly not understood how shocks inject electrons relative to protons. And I think that the best place to answer these questions is by modeling the emission, the broadband photon emission from young supernova remnants. So this is my what I mean by that. Young supernova remnants may be the best place where we can study high Mach number shocks. They get a global view of the blast wave. High Mach numbers, much higher than the heliosphere. So I'm contrasting this with the heliosphere. We have spacecraft observations of shocks. Supernova remnants give you a better view, I believe. You have an array of observatory space and ground base with good spatial and energy resolution. You get broadband continuum from radio to TEV gamma rays. X-ray emission lines from the shock heated gas contain a great deal of information. You have different classes of supernova remnants. And you see similar types in different environments at different ages and so on. All these things should be able to give us enough information to understand shock acceleration. Okay, you have a collisionless plasma. This is the key. Particles are coupled by magnetic fields, so you have strongly non-equilibrium particle spectrum possible. The shocks are important because they set up the converging plasmas on either side of the shock. We know that shocks exist. We know they accelerate particles efficiently. We see this in the heliosphere. We see it in particle and cell plasma simulations. All the shocks in the heliosphere are weak. The shocks in supernova remnants are much stronger and should be efficient ion accelerators. The efficient acceleration of cosmic ray ions in supernova remnants will impact the thermal properties of the shock-heated X-ray emitting gas. This is really important because we have these wonderful X-ray observatories, Chandra, XMM, etc., that are seeing the shock-heated gas. Well, the acceleration impacts the thermal gas. Also impacts the supernova remnant evolution and the broadband emission. Okay, real shocks inject the mind. We know this because we see it in the heatosphere. Here's the dots here are empty observations of the Earth's bow shock. This is downstream of the shock in a series of observations. You see protons, helium, and CNO. This is the time when the solar wind was almost radio. This shows that particles are being injected out of the thermal population. Smooth injection of thermal solar wind ions. This shock is efficient. Here's the Maxwell-Boltzmann that you get if you just heated the gas. This is what you see. The energy in this superthermal population is at least 25% of the total energy flux. So this shock is an efficient shock. Nonlinear, it shows nonlinear properties. When you fit this, you can only fit it properly with nonlinear effects. So here's a shock that works. Here's an interplanetary shock. Now this is much weaker, so you don't have nonlinear effects here, but you still see the injection from the thermal population.
I'm having trouble knowing the difference between the histogram and the dots.
The dots are the data, and the histogram is the model. Okay, and the same together. Okay. So the dots are actual spacecraft observations from Ulysses. And this is protons, and this is helium. Okay, from the shock. So we modeled this. This is Matthew and myself did it a while back. This is a highly oblique shock, yet it still shows the injection of the thermal properties. It's much less efficient than the bow shock. Do I have that here? Yeah. It's smooth injection of thermal solar wind, but much less efficient because of the high obliquity, almost certainly. But we see the injection occurring. That's protons. Yes.
This is for devil's advocate. I know that in the Maxwellian distribution, the last particles to thermalize are those at the high energy tail. So if you had just a super thermal population that's thermalizing, maybe not this one, but the previous one, it looks like it's a thermalizing. It hasn't yet thermalized to a Maxwellian distribution.
You mean like the bow shock?
Yeah.
Huh?
The previous, could go back to that one, though. This looks like an unthermalized Maxwellian.
Well, it's a. I don't.
Well, you're saying it's shock acceleration evidence, but if you dumped in particles into a thermal.
Well, eventually this will thermalize, of course. I mean, but these particles have been accelerated by the shock.
No, I think the problem is that the time for the acceleration is so short.
It's seconds.
Doesn't really develop here. If you see that, it breaks, it goes immediately into a cutoff situation. Mm-hmm. And that's what it makes look like a nonsense.
Yeah, it's both the time and the size. The bow shock is very small. The particles are leaking out.
It's hard to recognize a power law.
You don't see the standard power law in the heliosphere. That doesn't mean that shock acceleration is not working.
Chuck, your comments are predicated on the Spitzer time scale, and it's extremely long.
Yeah, this is accelerated literally in seconds. And the acceleration time is, I don't know, thousands of years. Okay, those were all protons. Now, it's very rare to see electrons, thermal electrons, injected and accelerated as shock. This is one of the two or three observations in 30 years of spacecraft being in the heliosphere. But this is a good one. Here we see, these are almost thermal. We don't have lower energies because the instrument couldn't measure them. But here you have electrons which are obviously accelerated. This is a four shock going up here. So this was measured by GeoTail. And most observations, the vast majority of heliospheric shocks show ions being accelerated, but do not show electrons. They show electrons not being accelerated.
Do you understand that, Don? I mean, why this doesn't happen? I mean, I've never fully understood.
No, absolutely not. I have something I believe, and that is
yeah, me too, but
the shocks are too weak.
Yeah, exactly.
But I don't understand it for sure.
Okay.
What is the difference? What's special about this particular?
It's just a higher Mach number.
It's an
exceptionally high Mach number interplanetary shock.
Uh-huh.
You see, the highest Mach number of any interplanetary heliospheric shock is about 10. And so electrons are subsonic in these shocks.
And this space?
This was around 10. This is
so
one of
like the fastest shocks you show the electrons?
Well, there's only been two or three. Okay. Most interplanetary shocks have Mach numbers of 2.
You see, yeah. The problem may be that the injection needs a threshold.
Exactly.
And that is not the case for ions, but for electrons, presumably there's a threshold. That's the only explanation.
Yeah, that's the only thing I can guess. But it, because this is critical, because in supernova remnants, we only really see the accelerated electrons.
Yeah.
So it's the...
What is the ratio between the electron and proton?
I don't know offhand. I have the paper, actually, if you want to read me. But I don't know offhand.
But you mean the ratio of the energy in the accelerated parts, protons versus electrons?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the number.
Yeah, hopefully you could get that, but it's not clear because they don't have the thermal part here, but I don't know.
So how do we read these graphs? Where is the shock and which? Where?
The shock is right here. So what? This is an interplanetary shock, so the spacecraft's sitting there, the shock comes by.
Yeah.
So this is basically a time scale. So this is the precursor, the shock has not hit the spacecraft yet. As you get closer, you see this increase in the electron versus energy. So this is energy going up.
Yeah.
This is just what you would expect. The precursor gets longer for the higher energy particles.
Okay.
And the protons, you see it very clearly.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
And then there's the shock. And downstream, these things are very complicated.
Yeah. So.
So does this have something to do with the ratio of cosmic rays at Earth?
Nothing.
GB or
this has nothing to do with it.
No, but if you count electrons at Earth or protons at Earth, there's a factor of 100 there.
Right.
So is it related to that?
Not in a direct way.
It's simply a propagation of that.
No.
These are not cosmic rays.
I realize that, but
this is probably related to the same thing. The electrons are less efficiently accelerated.
Also,
shocks that accelerate the cosmic rays.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But these are not these shocks.
Yeah, I realize that, but I'm just surprised to hear that.
Yeah, it is surprising. And the whole problem of electrons is a big problem, particularly for gamma bursts, because they're, in relativistic shocks, it's even harder to inject and accelerate electrons compared to protons than it is in non-relativistic shocks.
There we know that the efficiency is very high.
And that's another problem. You have to do it non-linearly because you know the efficiency is high. You can't use test particle necessarily.
I'm sorry. I thought John Kirk was just telling us that non-linear effects in relativistic shocks are
weaker. They're weaker if it's high ultra-relativistic because the spectrum's steep. But if you have a weaker shock, you have to worry about it. PIC simulations, particle and cell, hybrid simulations, we learn a lot from these. Have to be careful from the dimensionality, you really have to do them in 3D. This is a 1D result, it's a recent result from Joe Giacalone. I just wanted to show it. This shows the injection of thermal ions, so you see it in the simulation just like you see it in the spacecraft. The problem here is making these big enough to see the acceleration to high energies. The boxes are just too small. But what you do see, you do see the shock smoothing I'm going to talk about from the backstream pressure of the particles. Actually, I can go slower, but I just have a lot of graphs.
But can you explain in some more detail what is that? What is actually the simulation?
This is a plasma simulation.
Right.
So you put the particles in a box and you propagate them.
How many steam depths? Is this three-dimensional?
This is a one-dimensional.
It's one-dimensional.
So it's a parallel shock, one-dimensional.
Mm.
So the results are questionable because of that. I just wanted to show it as an example.
But the distribution function is three-dimensional.
Yes. This is three-dimensional. Right. You see, what's happening here is that the box is being made larger.
Mm.
And as you make the box larger...
So this is the number of skin depths.
Yes, this is the free escape boundary, basically. So it's the edge of the box.
Yeah.
So it goes from 2,000 to 10,000 to 20,000. And what's happening is that you're developing your power law. To get the power law to relativistic energies, you'd have to have a box much, much larger. Every cell in the box has to be filled with particles. You'd have to run it longer. Plus, you'd have to do it in three dimensions. As of now, and probably in our lifetimes, no PIC simulation is going to be able to simulate the acceleration of thermal particles to relativistic energies for normal parameters.
Don, there is always this problem that these PIC simulations hardly ever get you to something close to Coffee power.
That's right, because they're not big enough.
Because how quickly this is where it stops.
Absolutely.
It's really a problem.
They're not big enough. You can model the Bob shock for them, because it's about the same thing.
Yeah.
This is one of my points. But if you want to understand injection, this is the only real way to understand it. If you want to know all the physics that's going on, the problem is that you can't accelerate really high energy particles, and the injection process depends on the high energy particles because of the feedback effect, if it's nonlinear.
So, did you self-consistently calculate the magnetic fields?
Yes.
And the electric fields?
Yes, everything is self-consistent in this, except that it's a hybrid, so you don't have any electrons.
But if it's one-dimensional, what type of waves are you exciting in this plasma? Because the magnetic field generation or electromagnetic wave generation, you would have to be multidimensional. It cannot be a simply one-dimensional plasma.
Actually, I would prefer if we talked about this later. Okay.
One dimension would you have electrostatic waves, but not anything.
There must be some description
to
simulate the waves.
No, the waves are not simulated. What you're solving, you have particles, one dimensional simulation, plasma simulation, the particles are infinite plane sheets of charge. Okay, this is one of the problems with it. And these infinite plane sheets of charge are moving. They can move in three dimensions basically, but there's only variation in one dimension. And when they move, they produce currents, and those currents produce magnetic fields. And that's what and the magnetic fields are self-consistently calculated in these simulations. And you can start off with only noise. The other talk that I had prepared, which I decided not to show yesterday, I had a lot more of this stuff in it, but. You can start off with only noise far upstream. The particles bounce off the wall. You get backstreaming particles. They then develop these instabilities, which create the strong magnetic field. The shock is created. The shock then propagates through the box. Let me show you those later. Okay. Very quickly now. This is the test particle power law. John talked about this. Particles bounce back and forth across the shock, and produces power law. The normalization of this is not defined in the test particle approximation. So it's only superthermal particles. So even though any real plasma is going to have a thermal distribution plus a power law, that thermal distribution is not described in the test particle result. So this is the quasi-universal power law that people talk about. However, it's not that simple. If you have a strong shock with R equals 4, compression ratio is 4, you get N is P squared times F of P. It's basically E to the minus 2, or F to the proportion of P to the minus 4. You integrate that to infinity and it diverges if R is equal to 4 or greater. Okay? You're going to produce relativistic particles. That's going to lower the ratio of specific heats. That's going to increase the compression ratio, which is going to make the spectrum even flatter. That means the divergence is worse. You must have a high energy cutoff in the spectrum to attain a steady state. Particles will escape at the cutoff. It's just like a radiative shock on your radiating particles instead of photons. This radiation will cause the compression ratio to increase even more. The spectrum gets flatter. The escape gets greater. The nonlinear effects become more important. Strong shocks, all this leads to the fact that these shocks are going to efficiently accelerate particles. Strong shocks will be efficient accelerators, even with large compression ratios, even if injection occurs at modest levels. Say one ion in 10 to the 4th are injected, you still have efficient acceleration. So when you have very large compression ratios, and there's no real limit on the compression ratio, it can become infinite. This is the limit on the spectrum, it becomes very flat. If now you have a diffusion coefficient, which is an increasing function of momentum, the superthermal spectrum will be curved. So you end up with something like this. The test particle result on this plot is a flat power law. We're plotting P to the 4th times this. This is what you get with nonlinear effects. Compression ratio for this particular example is 12.5. This calculation comes from Blasi et al. So this is the type of spectrum that you're going to get with nonlinear shocks. So now what do we have? Now, because of the acceleration is efficient, the shock becomes smooth because of the back pressure of the cosmic rays. You get this effect. This curved shock translates to this concave spectrum here. So you get a concave spectrum. You get a compression ratios greater than 4, giving you a very flat spectrum there. Simultaneously, you must get, as this becomes flatter and more energy accumulates here, the temperature must go down. The temperature must become less.
These simulations are again with some prescription for the scattering.
This is the only thing that these conclusions depend on is that the diffusion coefficient is an increasing function of momentum. All of these results.
Okay, so you have diffusion of particles, and then you do this calculation of self-consistency. But the diffusion is
momentum dependent, which is certainly the case. Okay, so this is very interesting that this temperature drops as the acceleration becomes more efficient, because this connects the thermal X-ray emission to the broadband emission at very high energies. So that means that the entire spectrum must be described self-consistently, because the photon emission is connected across the entire spectrum. And of course you lose your nice universal power law now. Now, if I plotted this on, without multiplying by p to the fourth, this is what I would get. It's not very noticeable. And again, the most important point for X-ray observations is this decrease in the temperature. So this is kind of hard to see in the cosmic ray observations. This is what you get if you take a supernova and you evolve it over 40,000 years. The spectrum, actually Heinz did this years ago, essentially the same calculation. And the spectrum gets steeper, but it still does not get steep enough in these calculations to match the cosmic ray all part of the spectra. So this is what this curve is here. This is the cosmic ray observations. This doesn't look too bad here, but of course it looks a lot worse when you flatten it out.
By cosmic ray observation, you mean what?
The green.
Yes, but what do you mean, photon spectrum?
No. Photons, basically, all particle.
But how do you measure that in supernova?
Now, what I'm doing is I'm comparing the particle spectrum, the proton spectrum, from a single supernova remnant evolved over its lifetime to what we see with the galactic cosmic rays.
But the galactic cosmic rays have escape and all sorts of other complications.
Yeah, I've put in the, I've steepened this from the propagation effect by some rigidity dependence.
Yeah, but you don't really know how it behaves with those energies.
No, but this spectrum is too flat. It's too flat.
And normalization is arbitrary.
Completely. Oh yeah, I just wanted to show that the red curve is flatter than the green curve, and that this is a serious problem if you want to produce the galactic cosmic ray spectrum in a single supernova remnant. What I believe is that you don't. You produce it in many, and maybe you have many all with flatter spectrum, but they are adding together to give you the secret.
So maybe I'm missing this problem. The fact that the spectrum it produces is flatter, right? The escape would make it steeper.
Yeah.
So I don't understand the sense of the direction of the argument.
We know approximately how much it would worry if it were
on the other way around, because I wouldn't see how the propagation could flatten it. But I can.
We know that escape from the galaxy steepens the source spectrum, but we know approximately how much that steepening is.
Well, you don't really know it about the TV.
No, of course not. But you know it down here.
Yeah. Down here.
And what we know is that there are limits on how much you can steepen the source spectrum, and that the source spectrum cannot be much flatter than e to the minus 2.1 or 2.2.
You get an anisotropy problem, if you were to make the diffusion account for the difference between that steep accelerated spectrum.
And this is only if you know if you have a particular model for the diffusion out of the galaxy, which you don't.
Yes, they have very good models of that.
You have models, but I'm not sure that any of them is correct. I mean, I don't think we really understand the escape of cosmic rays from the galaxy.
Well, it's been modeled.
Well, if you put some numbers together, you find that you get 10.
Yeah, no, I'd be
able to love.
I think really the problem is that an e to the minus 2 spectrum doesn't easily convert in an e to the minus 2.7 spectrum, because that difference is very large. So you can discuss how well and how, but in general, something in between is possible. But the 0.7 difference is not easy to achieve.
Yeah, yeah. Let me show you the best is yet to come.
Given that we don't have a basic for the escape from the galaxy.
Yeah, in principle.
Maybe we should let go on, otherwise we'll be
Sure.
This, a lot of people have done this calculation. This calculates how much of the total supernova explosion energy can go into cosmic rays. You typically get values around 50%. Gresko did this, Heinz did this, Dorfi did it quite a while ago. The efficiency is not a problem. In fact, it's so efficient that you don't even have to do it over the entire surface of the remnant to power cosmic rays. So efficiency is not a problem.
The observations are a problem. They don't show anything like that.
Yeah, I never accept
observations. No, be careful. This is really not true.
Okay.
But, I mean, we can't go into that.
Okay. So, now, what can we do with individual supernova remnants? Well, the point is that theory suggests that supernova remnants can be extremely efficient. What do observations say? Well, now we look at the observations over the entire band from radio to TEV gamma rays. So we have all these active X-ray spacecraft. In supernova remnants, thermal X-rays come from shock-heated gas. Radio, non-thermal X-rays, and gamma rays come from shock-accelerated particles. So we can look at radio for the accelerated electrons. We can look at ground-based gamma ray telescopes for the very energetic gamma rays. Of course, this is Hess. This is an old photograph, but Heinz can talk more about this, of course. And this is what I wanted to really emphasize. So here's Kepler's supernova remnant. This is a radial map from the VLA, very large array. And this is the same remnant with Chandra in the X-rays. And they're drawn presumably to the same scale. The radio here is synchrotron emission from GeV electrons. The X-rays is a mixture of thermal from shock-heated gas and non-thermal. The non-thermal is synchrotron emission from TeV electrons. Okay. So now you look at, this is Kepler's. What was the other one? Kepler? Okay. This is Kepler also. So now you look at, this is Chandra observations of Kepler. You see, right in here, you see a section showing it's a thermal emission. You see the spectral lines. This is a total from the entire remnant. If you look at the non-thermal portion here, you see a spectrum which is very, very distinct from the thermal. So you can separate the non-thermal, which is from the TeV electrons, and the thermal, which is shock-heated ejecta. So you can find out basically where the forward shock is and where the contact discontinuity is with Chandra observations. And the point is, and what I want to emphasize, is that these can be very, very close together in portions of these remnants. Okay, so this is seen, this non-thermal emission is seen in a number of remnants. It could be seen in all of them if we had the sensitivity. What about the efficiency? The efficiency of shock acceleration is determined by the acceleration of ions, not electrons. We see the emission from electrons, but it's ions that are going to be efficiently accelerated. So far, there's no unambiguous evidence for ion acceleration. Direct evidence requires observation of pion decay photons.
On neutrinos.
Indirect evidence may come from morphology. This is what I want to emphasize here. Indirect evidence can come from the morphology of supernova remnants. Okay. Impact of efficient cosmic ray production on the morphology. So here we have, this is Tycho. Again, we see this situation. We can have radio, we can have X-rays. We can isolate the forward shock and the contact discontinuity. And what we find is that the radial distance between the outer shock and the contact discontinuity seems extremely small in several remnants. Okay, this is the same image again for Kepler and Tycho's. And what you can do, very crudely, and this can be done a lot better than this, you can find the ratio of the contact discontinuity divided by the forward shock, and it's really quite small, almost one here, same here. And the point is that in a normal hydro model, when you model this, this separation is much larger than this. This ratio is typically less than 0.8, and here you see it greater than 0.9. So what's an exploration field? And it's really, it's quite hard to change this in normal hydro models. An exploration is that the shocks are efficiently accelerating cosmic rays. That efficient acceleration produces compression ratios which are much greater than 4. The gas in here is compressed to higher densities than it would normally be, and this region is just spatially smaller. So this, I contend, is evidence, could be evidence for the efficient acceleration. So here's our model. We have the shocks ejected here. We have the shock ISM here. We produce, this is a normal hydro simulation with no acceleration. You see the separation here between the contact discontinuity and the forward shock, and so on. We're going to use this to model a remnant like this.
How secure is this identification of the position of the contact discontinuity based on the thermal emission?
Extremely good, actually. You can do it with Chandra. It's very clear, because you can separate the non-thermal and the thermal emission in Chandra. And Chandra has very high spatial resolution.
But how can you be so certain that you have no thermal emission beyond the quantum discontinuity?
Because of the composition changes abruptly from the shock project and the shock ISM. So the spectral lines are different.
Okay, so it's the lines. It's not the it's not the issue of the thermal emission. It's the issue of the lines that you see.
Yeah, the composition of the ejector is very different from the composition of the ISM. So this is the difference here. With no acceleration, you get a separation, which is like this. With shock acceleration, this is much smaller. Okay, and we've done this in two and even three dimensions, and you can see that when you include acceleration, the contact discontinuity becomes closer to the forward shock, and eventually it can even overtake it like this. And this is observed, where you have ejected material poking out of the forward shock in some remnants. Now, there could be other explanations for this, of course, but this is one that we have.
Physically, why is it that it collapses down to a smaller scale? Is it because it's a cooler conjugate?
Two. One thing, the gas is cooler, but the other thing is that the density is greater. So you have the same amount of mass, but the density is greater. So it just gets smaller, because the compression ratio of the shock is
change the equation of state, so you increase a lot the compression factor.
Yeah. And it's a big effect. It's more than a factor of two. So this, if you see this, you're seeing the efficient acceleration of ions via photons produced by electrons. That's what I like about it.
So just going from gamma 5/3 to 4/3 is enough to do that?
Well, actually, you go to gamma even less than 4/3. 4/3 would be the case if you had all relativistic particles, but you also have these escaping high-energy particles, which makes an even lower effective ratio of specific heats. So you need compression ratios of 15 or 20 in the models. And this, of course, in the fact, it's simultaneous with a lower shock temperature, proton temperature, that's what we're getting. But this impacts the thermal emission of the X-ray. So there's a lot of things that can be checked with this. Signature of efficient interaction region is narrower and denser. Shock proton temperature is less. Okay. However, not so obvious in some cases. I showed you cases where where it was really close. But here's Cas A, where now the forward shock, it's not as easy to find it, but clearly the forward shock is well separated from the contact discontinuity. Well, this could be one that there isn't efficient shock acceleration, it's inefficient. But what we have found, I've done a recent paper with this with Kassam Chinay, is that in a type 2 supernova remnant, we have a pre-supernova wind. The explosion going off in the wind changes the hydrodynamics, and you can get efficient acceleration and still have this separation here. You can't get it in type 1a without efficient acceleration. But in type 2 with the wind, you can get this separation. And so if you're really sure that you have a type 1a, then you better have a narrow region in here to have efficient acceleration. Okay, now what about seeing pions directly, the pion decay photons? Of course, this is the whole thing with Hess. And the problem here is that there's a competition between inverse Compton from electrons and pion decay emission from the protons at these GeV, TeV energies. Even if you see TeV gamma rays, they may be from electrons. So this is the problem. I just want to say a few words about this. This is what we get from from the proton and electron spectra that we calculate, these are approximations, these produce the thermal X-rays, these electrons produce the radio synchrotron, these electrons produce the X-ray synchrotron and the inverse Compton, and the protons produce the pion decay. So you produce the broadband photon emission from these various parts of these spectra, and then you can investigate it with the various spacecraft. The relative intensity of the inverse Compton and the pion decay, this of course is critical for these TEV observations, depends strongly on ambient conditions, mainly on the density. It's only really the shape that of the observed spectrum that can distinguish them. But in principle, broadband models connect the emission here to the emission over the entire range, so it can help to constrain these spectra. Here's the famous, incredibly wonderful observation of G347 from Hess. First gamma ray image of a supernova remnant. Here's the spectrum, really quite flat. No evidence of cutoff. The only thing I wanted to say about this is that here we have two spectra, inverse Compton and pion decay. And again, the relative normalization depends on models and on supernova remnant parameters. So it's not so easy in this range right here to distinguish them. You need extremely good statistics, but broadband models can help. And the reason for saying this is that we have this other way of determining that protons are being accelerated efficiency, and that's by looking at the morphology. That does not tell you that you're producing high energy protons. You can be accelerating protons efficiently, but not getting enough to these high energies. If you want to know that you're producing protons to these high energies, you have to see the pion decay feature. Glass should be a great help here, hopefully. One last thing, I guarantee. Important question for shock acceleration concerns the geometry of the magnetic field. Are quasi-parallel shocks more or less efficient accelerated than quasi-perpendicular? Here's a supernova remnant, supposed to have an ambient field like this. You're going to have a quasi-parallel shock here, quasi-perpendicular shock there. Here's 1006. Bright limbs here, are these quasi-parallel or quasi-perpendicular regions? This is dominated by non-thermal emission. Clear example of a shell supernova remnant. Okay, there are two possibilities, barrel geometry or polar caps. Okay, if you have barrel geometry, if these bright limbs are from a barrel shape, the problem with this is that it predicts emission in the center. Okay, until Chandra, nobody could really map the emission across the remnant.
Sufficient XMM. XMM. This was before. It was XMM which allowed this.
XMM, I'm sorry. Not XMM. Okay. If it's polar caps, then you have this, but there's no little or no emission in the center. This is Ruben Kluge at Sacre that basically have done this work. Until Chandra and XMM, maybe Chandra can't do it, I may be mistaken. This was not measurable for non-thermal emission. But what do we see? This is what's seen for 1006. You have the limbs right here, and you have this emission in the center, which is really very low. The prediction for a barrel-shaped with an equatorial belt is right here. Conclusion is clear evidence for polar caps. And if they are polar caps, the ambient magnetic field for this remnant lies along the galactic plane. Now, there are other problems with that as well, but that seems to be a pretty clear result. Okay, I think I'm going to stop there. There's other reasons for believing that supernova remnants are accelerating cosmic rays efficiently. This is some work that I've done also earlier, Dreschko and Heinz and other people. Okay, I will stop there. Thank you.
Maybe on this last floor, isn't one of the more important things you learn from this is maybe amplification of fluctuations in the magnetic field ahead of the shock?
Yeah, this is one conclusion.
Because you see that this rapid sort of drop in the flux.
Yeah, this one conclusion, and this paper makes that, is that the magnetic field is probably very high here, and that it's probably amplified.
Amplified by the shock itself.
By the shock itself, right?
I mean, one can do that for for all young supernova remnants where there exist gender measurements. Mm-hmm. And in all cases you see considerable amplification. So that is one point I wanted to make when you say how difficult it is to disentangle pi-zero decay from inverse Compton. Once you can determine the magnetic field, its amplified value, then you can say, I know the knowing the synchrotron emission, mm-hmm. I know then uniquely the inverse Compton part of it, because I know now the magnetic field and the distribution function. And then you can calculate what the inverse Compton emission would be, and that then you can compare to any observation. And if the observation is higher, it's for sure that there's no alternative than pi-zero decay. And in the case of supernova 1006, for example, the Hess upper limit, which is actually now confirmed by Kangaroo, by new measurements of Kangaroo, they say they now also do not detect it. If you take the Hess upper limit, it would be completely incompatible with any inverse Compton emission for any reasonable, in quotes, interstellar medium. So in order to depress the inverse Compton below the Hess upper limit, you need an enormous field amplification, which actually comes out exactly in the form determined here. So in this sense, I think we are in a much better situation than one might think of. Spectral features alone are very difficult, except for higher cutoffs for the pi-zero emission. But knowing the magnetic field by these morphological measurements determines the inverse Compton, and of course the ionic part, this pi-zero decay, is also determined, but that is through theory, and then
the
you see what
the
pi-zero decay gamma rays are determined then on a purely theoretical level, and that you can simply then compare to the observation. So I think we are in a not bad shape as far as this is concerned, rather different from what I personally thought maybe 5 years ago. I was quite skeptical at that time. I'm not so anymore.
Yeah, I agree completely with what Hans said. And part of what I was saying is that the broadband models, when you say determine the magnetic field, of course you use the radio to help determine the magnetic field.
Exactly.
So that's part of it. You're doing a spectrum over this entire range. Plus, the magnetic field through this nonlinear diffusive shock acceleration model affects everything else. It affects the shock heating and so on and so forth.
Yeah, the point Heinz was referring to, I think, is that you can infer the amplification of the field from the morphology rather than from the
exactly
from
yeah.
the spectrum.
Yeah, the hatched here, by the way, is the data.
It's the sharp morphology downstream, which is so amazing. Yeah.
There's also this jump here. You see, this is not the precursor. All of this stuff is behind the forward shock.
Yes.
This is the precursor right here.
Exactly.
And this jump occurs because the magnetic field is compressed, and as it would be in the shock.
For example, in the case of Tycho's supernova remnant, you get a downstream effective field which is about 300 micrograms. Assuming this to be a supernova 1A, type 1A, you know, supposedly uniform interstellar medium, you would expect maybe 20 micrograms downstream, but not 10 times more. So this is a very clear case that of amplification, and then that determines everything else.
But this does introduce complication, because if you really want to have a self-consistent model, this amplification of the field has to be calculated with the scattering.
Yeah, of course, but that can be done. I mean, in fact, we have done that in 3 cases, and it comes out self-consistently. In other words, you determine the magnetic field from the nonlinearity of the synchrotron spectrum. You you consider that as giving you the magnetic field, and then you calculate the rest. And first of all, you can get a consistent electron spectrum, making a consistent synchrotron spectrum. And secondly, you can now compare this magnetic field determined by spectral measurements in theoretical calculation only with the directly determined magnetic field from the size of the synchrotron sharpness of the boundary. You can directly determine magnetic field, and the outcome is the same. So you get a consistent result. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, so just to go for coffee and continue discussing there.